So thank you all again very much for joining us. My name is Athena Foule. I am the Fulbright Scholar Program Outreach and Recruitment Manager at the Institute of International Education. We have the distinct honor and privilege of administering the Fulbright Scholar Program on behalf of the U.S. Department of State. The presentation today is going to be a brief discussion of some of our general overview and information about the program, which is very important to share with you because Fulbright is a very mission-driven opportunity, and that's the kind of information we definitely want our candidates to know about so that you can better incorporate that into your projects and goals and objectives of the grants that you are all applying for. Then I will take us through a walkthrough of our website, show you where you can find additional resources, go through a few of the opportunities we have in our catalog of awards. And then the majority of the time that we'll be spending together this afternoon will be spent answering any questions you might have. So as I talk about our opportunities and show you information on our website or to show you the slides that I'm about to present, as you have questions, feel free to go ahead and start putting them in the question box. And my colleague, Chanel Vismara, is joining us on this call today, and she will be monitoring those questions as well. And when it's time for the question and answer period, we'll be sure to answer as many of those as we possibly can. And I'm also happy to refer you to our virtual office hours that take place every Thursday for this region, East Asia, the Pacific, as well as the Middle East, North Africa, which will be taking place tomorrow, but more on that shortly. But in the meantime, please continue to ask any questions you have, and we'll be sure to try and answer as many of those as we possibly can by the end of this session. So a little bit about the Fulbright program. As I mentioned, it is a very mission-driven program, so what does that mean? When you're looking at the Fulbright program versus other government-funded grants, NSF, NIH, or anything like that, or even some of the privately corporate-funded grants, Gates, Schwarzman, etc., the thing that sets Fulbright apart, or one of the many things that sets Fulbright apart, is its partnership with over 160 countries worldwide. So the Fulbright program is primarily funded by U.S. taxpayer dollars, congressionally appropriated annually through the Department of State to administer opportunities for passionate and accomplished faculty, administrators, artists, journalists, lawyers, and professionals from all backgrounds. For the opportunity to study, teach, or conduct research. Fulbright has been around since 1946, and it is considered the flagship international educational and cultural exchange program for the United States government. So the fact that this program exists and is funded through the State Department really says a lot about its overall overarching mission of fostering mutual understanding between nations, advancing knowledge across communities, and improving lives around the world. We are celebrating our 75th anniversary next year. So that is a long history of really engaging with the world, sharing ideas, improving lives around the world, as well as a pillar of public diplomacy, citizen-to-citizen diplomacy for the United States government. So in all of the discussions that you're doing, you're obviously, well, I hope you're on this call because you're interested in applying for a Fulbright grant, but keeping in mind that Fulbright, again, has this mission, has this objective of making sure that we're being a bridge between countries, being a bridge across disciplines, and being able to foster those relationships between citizens and countries. So as I mentioned, it was established in 1946, and the State Department, the U.S. Department of State, is funded annually through appropriations, as I mentioned there. When you're looking at the logos on this side, on the top left, you'll see the newly branded Fulbright logo. On the bottom left, you'll see the Department of State's logo. And on the right, again, is the organization that I work for, the Institute of International Education, which is the nonprofit organization that administers the Fulbright Scholar Program and the Fulbright Student Program on behalf of the State Department. I know you're visiting a variety of different websites and things like that, but it's important to know that for these opportunities, those are the major stakeholders that will be reviewing and working with you on your application. We have a slide on diversity inclusion because, as I pointed out on that previous slide, as the flagship academic and cultural exchange program of the United States, the Fulbright program strives to ensure that the program itself reflects the diversity of U.S. society as well as the societies abroad. So in a few slides, I'll share a little bit more in terms of numbers of who's participating in the program. But we are actively seeking and encouraging the involvement of people from traditionally underrepresented audiences in all of our opportunities, programs, and initiatives. So the State Department defines that as being open to people regardless of their race, color, national origin, sex, age, religion, geographic location, socioeconomic status, disability, sexual orientation, or gender identity. By diversity inclusion, we mean different types of institutions, different types of academic fields, different ranks of the academy. We really want this to be as robust of a representation of American higher ed and professional fields as possible going abroad as cultural and educational ambassadors for the United States. So why Fulbright? There are a lot of opportunities out there for funding, so what is bringing you particularly to this Fulbright table, proverbial table, so to speak, is there are certain aspects that does make the Fulbright program special and unique, starting with the fact that we have over 380, we're coming up on 400,000 Fulbrighters who have participated in these exchanges since the 1940s. And Fulbright is truly transformational. As opposed to grants that you might have with a specific department or institution or lab or research center, Fulbright really, since it has that cultural diplomacy aspect to it, we are sending families abroad. We are sending people to really become involved and have that cultural exchange aspect when they are participating in these grants. So this is not, you're not in a silo, you're not in this grand ivory tower of academia. We really want to see projects that are demonstrating how you will be transformed and how you'll be transforming your field and the host countries that are hosting you. So the relationships that happen on Fulbright are real and truly lasting. We have evidence of our grantees talking about continued collaborations decades after their experiences. Fulbright allows you to expand your publishing network. You become more cultural in your classroom as multiculturalism and the globe is increasingly shrinking. Fulbright provides you the opportunity and expertise to really address and learn, get that experience to better serve your different multicultural classrooms and fields of study. You're serving as a cultural ambassador for international education and exchange. You get professional recognition as being identified as a Fulbright scholar, and again, there's a vibrant alumni network all over the world who are actively working in fields and promoting the mission of the program again, which is developing and fostering mutual understanding between cultures, countries as well. Fulbright is family friendly. 60% of our awards provide dependent support. We really want you taking family members and dependents with you whenever possible, because again, when you're looking at it as a cultural diplomacy piece, that's a very important aspect of what we're trying to do. We want these countries to meet Americans, and we want Americans to really experience what life is like abroad to better foster that understanding within our own cities and cultures and districts, I should say. Many Fulbright dependents go on to have international careers. A few years ago, one of our most popular blog posts was written by a dependent who went with her mother to Argentina and has talked about how the Fulbright has shaped her life as well as her mother's when she was on her grant. So keep in mind how this can affect your family in the long term. And Fulbright is supportive. We have alumni who are very active and share their experiences and are happy to help advance the cause of the program and work with people before and after their grant and collaborate. And we have domestic and in-country staff assistance. So domestically, when you apply through us in Washington, D.C., we try to be as helpful and informative as we can in our interactions with you. But when you arrive in-country, because of that partnership with 130 to 160 countries around the world, we are administered by either a Fulbright Commission in that country or the U.S. Embassy there. So Fulbright by the numbers, just to give you, again, a couple more slides on just some overall context of the larger Fulbright program. We fund over 8,000 awards annually, or Fulbright funds over 8,000 awards annually. The core of what we're going to be talking about today, the large substantive piece of what we're discussing, is the 800, the very first bullet point there, the 800 opportunities for U.S. scholars, professionals, and administrators to go abroad. That said, it is important to understand where it fits within the larger Fulbright constellation or Fulbright universe. So we have about 900 visiting scholars who come to the United States. We send out another 2,200 U.S. students out annually. We receive about 4,000 foreign students to complete their graduate studies here in the United States, as well as bring about 400 language teaching assistants. So since 1946, again, 390, we're going to cross that threshold into 400,000 in this coming year who have participated in the program since its inception. So for the 2018-19 award cycle, this is basically how it's broken down in again, we're focusing on the U.S. scholar piece, right? These awards allow academics and professionals to participate in a variety of different activities. We are known in many circles to be a fantastic way to conduct research, and we definitely have peer research awards at about 28% of the 800 or so that were offered last year. We have a majority of what we're offering is a combination of teaching research at 38%. If you're only interested in going abroad to do teaching, we definitely have opportunities for that too. We have these short-term study tours for higher education administrators that work in international education and exchanges that come in at 9%. And we do have a subset of awards specifically set aside for postdocs and postdoctoral research. So that's how the pie has been distributed for 18-19. So what is eligibility for the scholar program? U.S. citizenship is required, so anybody interested in going abroad from the United States to become a Fulbright U.S. scholar, U.S. citizenship is that first element of eligibility. We have over 800 grants to go abroad, but each award will have their varying degrees of requirements and experience listed for each opportunity. So a lot of what we offer will require a PhD or terminal degree in your field. An MA in higher education teaching or professional experience may be sufficient for some. If you're a professional outside of academia or an artist with substantial accomplishments, we're looking at in the range of at least 5 to 10 years of work in your field. And teaching experience, some awards will specifically say they want someone with no less than 10 years teaching experience, and others will say they want no more than 5 years teaching experience. All of that is specified more closely in that catalog. And we have policies regarding previous scholar awards and waiting periods between grants that I'm happy to answer any questions on if we have any people who have previously received Fulbright grants in their career. So 800 opportunities annually. The name of the game is really finding that Fulbright that works for you. Since this is an application process driven by the applicant, we're really leaning on you to tell us what you would like to do there. So since that responsibility lies in the candidate to craft the proposal and the type of project and grant activity that they would like to do, it is really a matter then of finding a Fulbright that works for you. I like to say that there's a Fulbright for everywhere, excuse me, there's a Fulbright for everyone somewhere in the world. But there's not a Fulbright for everyone everywhere in the world. So what I mean by that is like it's really a matter of matching and finding the suitability of what you'd like to do with a country interested in hosting what you're interested in doing. So again, I touched a little bit upon this. We have awards available throughout your career from early to mid-career, postdoc, straight through emeriti, adjunct, and independent scholars. We have flex options available in 63 countries and in all world regions that would allow you to visit a country over the span of 2 years, staying for about a month each stay. And we have global and regional awards that would allow you to visit more than one country, depending on the research or teaching project that you have in mind, if it requires a larger scope of work in terms of it's larger than one specific country's point of view. So you're ready to go. You have the project you'd like to do. Now, the next step would be to select the right award. Again, matching your expertise, experience, and proposal to the award description is key. You need to find the country. You need to find the award that suits what you're trying to accomplish and meet the needs of what is being described in that award description. Keep in mind the regional experience and language ability. Some countries do not want people who have had significant experience already in that country. I was working with somebody who was interested in going to Italy recently, and it said that they are not interested in having anyone who has had more than 5 years of experience in Italy. So all of that will vary from country to country. That's all spelled out in the award description. Discipline preferences when specified. So when we visit the catalog of awards, I can walk us through a little bit in more detail on that, but this idea that most of the world, about 90 countries, will have what we call an all-discipline award, which is basically that country saying, you tell us where you want to be and what you'd like to be doing, and then it's a basically a pretty open competition to whoever can make the best and most compelling case to be in the country for that period of time. Some countries will be very specific. We are looking for someone to teach American history or American literature to a classroom of 15 students 3 times a week. So in many cases, it might be a direct job description that you're filling out. In other cases, it might just be completely open. So all of that exists within that catalog. So please do a search by either your discipline and all disciplines. Don't feel that there isn't going to be an award for you just because your discipline might not necessarily be popping up, because again, you could be facilitated through your grant could be facilitated through those all discipline awards. Consider that, is the project relevant to the host country and how will communities benefit from your project? We get a lot of people who say this project is so important I can do it anywhere in the world. That's fantastic, but that is not necessarily going to make for a strong Fulbright project. We want Fulbright projects to be relevant and timely to the country that you're going to. Is that country grappling with this issue right now? Is the question that you're trying to answer something that they need your expertise and experience to help address? Are you providing a service? Are you building capacity? Are you doing something that matches the needs of what's happening in that country as well as whatever needs are happening in your own field, in your own work? That's important as well. And again, career level. Since we do have opportunities and a variety of different levels of a career, make sure you're just applying for the right one. Don't apply for a distinguished chair if you're an early career professional and academic, or if you're an early vice versa. If you're an early career academic, don't search for opportunities that are looking for distinguished chairs with over 20 to 30 years of experience in their field. So just finding that, reading the details on that is key too. So, in understanding the awards, I'll take us through the website shortly after I get through a couple more slides here, but I did want to point out a couple of things as we go through that catalog of awards, and I'll take us through a live version of this shortly. But this is basically how you would read this information. We have the first tab, which is award details, that'll tell you a little bit about the opportunity. So in this case, this is a grant to the Philippines. The grant activity is they are seeking someone to teach up to 2 undergraduate or a graduate course, conduct research or do both in your area of expertise in collaboration with the academic institution in that country. You can direct graduate student theses and consult on curriculum, etc. And preference will be given to activities that involve collaboration with local scholars. So you may be invited to give lectures or seminars at Philippine institutions as well. It says clearly 4 months of teaching and 5 months for any sort of teaching research grants. And if you're just doing pure research grants, you're really looking at 3 to 4 months for that. The deadline is September 15th, and that is for the 21-22 academic year. The next tab is award requirements, and again, I'll take us to our website shortly to show you all of that. Stipend and benefits, we're just pointing this out because oftentimes these tabs are overlooked, and a lot of great information there for you too. So, the application components, the requirements of the application. Yeah, there's an application form, and if you haven't started your application yet, I definitely encourage you to do so. As soon as we have your information as a registered prospective applicant, we will continue, and you tell us what world regions you're interested in, or you even pick a specific country, we can continue to start sending you updates for anything related to that region. If we're doing another one of these webinars, if we're doing a presentation, those sort of things are very useful, so I definitely encourage you all to plug in. That'll be sort of a homework assignment for you at the end of this call. I can show you where to do all of that. Another major component is that project statement. We have some excellent resources that we've just developed on that that I'll be showing you when we visit our website. Your CV or resume, we only require 2 letters of recommendation this year. That's in bold because that's new. Anybody who's previously applied to a Fulbright might have recalled that as being 3, but this year it's only 2. Language proficiency report, if required, for the world region that you're traveling to, but most of the world expects Americans to be lecturing in English, and a letter of invitation if it's required. And that letter of invitation, just to let you know, is the deadline for that this year. So the application deadline is September 15th, but the letter of invitation, obviously if you can get it in by September 15th, that'd be fantastic as well, but we are giving people a little bit more time just due to the pandemic. We know it's a little harder to get in touch with some colleagues overseas, but the letters of invitation will be to October 15th for this cycle. Supplemental materials are also requested of you if you plan to do any teaching. Course outlines or syllabi will be required. For any research that you're doing, a bibliography will be expected of you too. And for artists, architects, journalists, portfolio submissions as well are asked of you. So the most critical piece of this whole puzzle, if you're looking at all of these together, and the best way I can describe this process is understand how each piece of the application, how each component really is like a puzzle. You're using each piece and each element to express as robust and clear of a picture of who you are as a candidate. We'll have your application form to tell you a lot, to tell us a little bit about you and your career thus far. We'll have your project statement to tell us exactly what you plan to do and accomplish when you're on the ground in country. We'll have your CV to tell us a little bit about your background. So again, don't bother taking a lot of time in your project statement giving us a full history of your background. The reviewers will have your CVs to tell us that. Your letters of recommendation should demonstrate the scope and reach of the work that you're doing and your ability to outside points of view to your ability and skill set to be able to accomplish what you're proposing to do. And letter of invitation, if required, will be telling us a little bit about your relationship with the host that will be having you on campus. So there's no need to sort of double up or be redundant in any of these pieces. Each piece has a role to play, and whoever can most effectively use each element of this to articulate what you're planning to do tend to be the most successful. The same thing goes for supplemental materials. Your course outline and syllabi will tell us exactly what we need to know in terms of the course, the work that you're trying to do or the work that you have been doing or propose to do. But that narrative piece of the project statement is key. So what is that? You have 3 to 5 pages to discuss your proposed project in as much detail as possible. Focus on what you plan to do, the courses you plan to teach, the goals of your research, and your methods, if you're planning to do any research. So explain, and this is important, explain the anticipated impact of the award on your host, home institution, and you. So understand something like that you can't really explain in any other component, right? So definitely use the project statement to leverage that. And we have an 11-minute video from our Director of Academic Relations that I will show you too as well that has a lot of great insight and advice as well for the project statement. This year we also have some supplemental questions because, again, for that project statement, 3 to 5 pages to tell us what you plan to do on that grant, we know is not a lot. So we have pulled out these 4 key questions that we do want you to address. One, why Fulbright? I talked very early on in this session about all of the opportunities available for you. Why are you applying for Fulbright? What about the program is calling you? Why that particular country? How adaptable are you and how will you deal with challenging situations? And how will you adapt your materials to your host culture? So you'll no longer be teaching to a classroom in the United States or the cohort of students that you're likely you've been teaching this course to already. So how will you adapt and modify what you've been doing thus far to this new culture? That's our reviewers are definitely keen on seeing that. So let's say you are required to submit that letter of invitation. So a couple of places in our catalog of awards, which I will take us to shortly, but some will say, you know, you may affiliate with one of the following institutions, and they'll list the 2 campuses right there. Then you'll know exactly where you need to reach out to make that affiliation. On the right, you'll see one for Argentina, which just basically said any accredited institution of higher ed in that country. So when a host is not identified, we provided a couple of other options for you. Look at the award description for suggested host resources. There might be additional tabs saying here is a list of all the higher ed institutions in the country to help you start with your search. We always recommend visiting the U.S. and visiting scholar directories to see what U.S. scholars have gone abroad and what their projects are, and as well as what visiting scholars are in the United States from those countries, potentially from the institutions you're trying to affiliate with, and the international office on your campus if they have any existing relationships abroad. So on that second tab for award requirements, if that letter of invitation is required, it will say so. If it says a letter of invitation should not be sought, then that's very clear. It's saying that that country reserves the right to affiliate you accordingly. If it says a letter of invitation is preferred or is optional, I would take that as a case-by-case basis. We can read the awards, and if anybody has that kind of question, we can sort of take a look and see, but that usually means it would be in your favor to secure that. And what is that letter of invitation? Well, it should be a non-binding expression of interest from your host abroad, basically indicating that they know who you are, they're familiar with the project you would like to work on, and they would be happy to have conversations about working with you should you receive funding. It should be on the institution letterhead, and again, that date of those letters as part of your application will be October. The due date for that is October 15th. So before we get to the website, just a quick overview of the application cycle. Our catalog of awards opens annually in February. The deadline is September 15th for the following academic year. So September 15th, 2020 will be for fall 2021. In September, we do a technical review for completeness. There is a peer review that takes place from October to November in, it'll be completely virtual this fall, but yes, that takes place from October to November. November to January is the first time candidates will be notified of status. They will be, you will be told if you were recommended for further consideration, and if it, you are, then you will be sent on to the host country for review and the presidentially appointed J. William Fulbright Scholarship Board. Now, if you're not recommended for further consideration, you'll also receive that notification in November or through January. Once your information is forwarded on to the host country, which is an important detail to point out, you are writing for an American audience first and foremost. The information will not make it across the proverbial pond to whichever regions you're applying to unless it is approved and, recommended for consideration by that panel in the United States. But from January to April, we have final decisions, and from May onwards, participants prepare for departure, grant documents, health documents, et cetera. But that is basically the cycle from May onwards, with the recruitment cycle again continuing for the following year. So September 15th, 2021 will be for fall 22-23. Great. So I'm going to pull up our website. Our homepage is cies.org. A version of this PowerPoint is available. If you go to conferences, workshops, and webinars under the on-campus tool, this presentation will be archived in the past events and webinars tab right here. So if you click that tab, it'll link you to some past presentations for your review. So I know we're in a discussion right now, or we'll be in a discussion shortly about East Asia and the Pacific, but let's say you are also looking at opportunities in the Western Hemisphere. I would encourage you to see what's going on there. We have spotlights on specific countries as well. So that's the first place I would, if I've covered something today or you have like to review something that was mentioned, definitely look there. By clicking the Fulbright logo, it'll take you back to our homepage. Other resources that are here, you can access our webinars right here as well. So if you want, we have people doing presentations almost every day of the week leading up to the deadline in September, so always feel free to visit this and see if there are regions. We have Global Hidden Gems tomorrow that might suit what you're looking for. You can click a particular country to be taken to those opportunities here. I encourage you all to, I talked about this earlier, but a little homework assignment for you, but if by clicking Connect with Fulbright right there, you can register your interest and start to receive updates from us filtered to the kind of updates you'd like to receive, whether you're interested in teaching, research, a particular world region, an academic discipline. Or let's say you'd like to refer a colleague. If you know somebody who you think would be a fantastic Fulbright scholar, please let us know. We take those referrals very seriously and are happy to set up calls or send out an email to people to have a conversation. But this is also a very important resource here to join an office hour. As I mentioned, we're going to have one for East Asia and the Pacific and the Middle East, North Africa region tomorrow at 1 p.m. This is Eastern time. But these office hours are just opportunities for you to pop in and get your questions answered in a little bit more informal way. I know I've been presenting for about half an hour now, but that's a great way to just sort of pop in and out. And also just have in the background, if you want to hear what other questions people are asking, you might learn something there as well. Okay. So something to also take you to for programs. I'm sorry, let me go straight to the catalog of awards. From our homepage, cis.org, browse the catalog award. So let's go ahead and select the region, East Asia and the Pacific. We're going to search. So we have 44 awards. And how we sort of distinguish that is awards are opportunities to go abroad. By grants are specific individuals and projects that are going abroad. So we have, it's in alphabetical order, so we're starting with Australia for the Pacific. Scrolling down, we have Burma, Cambodia, Indonesia, Japan, Korea, Mongolia, New Zealand, Philippines, Singapore. Pretty robust list. And at the end, we have the ASEAN Research Program as well as the Public Policy Fellowship Award. So let's, I'm going to randomly pick, let's go with Indonesia. So let's say you're interested in going to Indonesia. We have an all-disciplines research opportunity, and we have an all-disciplines teaching opportunity. So let's click on research. So this page should look very familiar. It's basically resembles the slide I had in the presentation. To conduct research in your applicant's area of specialization, you should conduct research in your expertise. Projects may focus on contemporary Indonesia or be comparative in nature. You'll be asked to give public talks, train Indonesian research team members, engage with academic community. So this is basically the bullet points that you should be addressing in your project. The grant length is 5 to 10 months for research. So let's say you only want to go for a 3-month research project. This is obviously not going to be the case. They're being very clear here. The grant length is 5 to 10 months. Finding that match and suitability for what you'd like to do is key. It can begin any time from September 2021 through May 2022. Locations, most public and private universities throughout Indonesia, depending on permit approval. And they're telling you which ones are unlikely to receive, what regions are unlikely to receive government permission if necessary. It's an all-disciplines award, so submit projects that relate to all of that. Award requirements. So it says here the letter of invitation is preferred, in which case, additional information, it says it's strongly preferred, so definitely consider getting those for anybody interested in this opportunity. Language proficiency requirement is none. English is actually sufficient, but again, if you're doing research, you're going to need to somehow demonstrate to us that you can do the research that you'd like to do. You have the language capability to do that. Are you hiring somebody on site? Whatever it is, you'll need to be addressing that. PhD is required for this one. It is open to professionals and academics of all careers. Of all level of career. You must have a record of scholarly publications. And some important information to consider before applying. Research scholars should expect 1 to 2 months of obtaining local permits upon arrival. So build that into your project. If you're planning to go into a park area or conservation, that will require a longer processing time. So keep that in mind too. And additional helpful links. Since it's open to any institution, they're giving you a link to campuses and universities, the office in Indonesia, etc. Stipend and benefits. So this is also a very important tab. It's telling you how much the grant you will be receiving per month, and additional money that will be for housing, what you're getting in terms of travel and relocation allowance. And dependent allowance, as we mentioned, we are encouraging folks to bring dependents and family as they are interested and able. And in that case, for Indonesia, they're going to give a maximum of $5,000 per school-age child for tuition. And special award, an additional $400 to $500 a month for transportation allowance, a permit. One-time permit allowance, so any sort of permits will be required, will be provided. And lastly, the country area overview. So different countries use this differently, but it's a very, I wanted to direct you to that anyway, just because it's where a lot of these countries, when we're working with them to develop these awards, put their priorities. So keep in mind, if they're highlighting something about their country here, that might be something for you to consider in terms of the discussion you're having in your project statement. So definitely click every single one of these tabs as you're able. Pay special attention to what they're saying about their country. It's talking about cultural diversity and heritage, and it matches its natural diversity. So political reform since 1998, strengthen its democratic governance, largest economy in Southeast Asia, critical to regional stability, all sort of elements you might want to somehow pepper and season your project statement with to demonstrate that you're familiar with the country and what their priorities are and are cognizant of that. Okay, and the last thing I wanted to show you from CIES.org, so I showed you where to access the catalog of awards, I showed you where to connect with us and sign up for more information, is the scholar directory. So we're just going to stick with Indonesia for now. We're going to pick Indonesia here and see what U.S. scholars have gone abroad since 2010 to Indonesia. So this will tell you what their home institution is in the U.S., what their host institution, who hosted them abroad. So let's go with Abigail Cohn from Cornell, went to Atmajaya Catholic University. If you click that, it'll tell you a little bit more about them. Looks like they are in the Department of Linguistics. Was a research grantee in July 2012 to May 2013, and the project title was Language Contact in Indonesia, Shifts in Usage and Their Structural Manifestations. Now let's say you're actually interested in being affiliated with Gorontalo State University. So this scholar was there in 19 to 20. Looks like they were researching documentation, description, and analysis of the Suwawa language. So Russell Barlow may or may not have contacts for you at Gorontalo State University. Now I'm going to flip this sort of on its head and say, let's see what Indonesians are in the United States rather than U.S. scholars going our outbound. We're talking about non-U.S. visiting scholars from Indonesia coming to the United States. So Ludhiana University seems to have a few people coming to the U.S. We have Jakarta Theological Seminary, Tadulako University. Let's see where Andy Adam was from. They are from Palau in Indonesia. They were hosted at UW in the Center for Global Field Study. And they were here in 22 to 13 doing research, improving teaching and research in the Department of Civil Engineering. So the scholar directory is a very interesting place to just do a little research of what's being funded in that country as well as who is doing that work. You can also, if you don't want to look at program country and you just want to look at a particular discipline, let's say you're in geography, you can click discipline and that'll pull up all of the visiting scholars who are in the United States since 2010 working in the field of geography, where they went in the world, country program, the discipline, and the institutions they were affiliated here in the United States. So that is the last piece of information I wanted to show you on the website, but I will actually keep the website open, but then we'll start to take some questions. So bear with me as I open up that box and start getting to your inquiries here. Okay. So what to do if a Fulbright scholar has a problem beyond needing to be flexible? How often does a Fulbright scholar think she needs to cut his or her visit short? That's a little hard to answer. I mean, what to do if a Fulbright program has a... So because there's a lot in the air at the moment in terms of what's going on in the world, obviously if grants happen, family gets sick, or, you know, unfortunately things happen that will require you to cut a grant short, and that definitely happens year after year. And we deal with it as necessary, since we are, in the case of most of the opportunity for sure that I mentioned today in Indonesia, the Fulbright office in that country will work to you to make sure that your safety is first and foremost paramount and important. But if you need to come home early, then yeah, that happens, and that is definitely something that happens in different places around the world. So it's not like we'll force you to remain in that country. I don't know if there's necessarily a percentage of how many people need to cancel the grant, but in terms of like the canceling a grant or cutting a grant short, and likelihood of returning to that country or deferring a grant or anything like that is slim. So there is no deferral functionality within the Fulbright program, since we are tied to funding per year. For example, if your program is cut short or if you need to come home, then that will essentially be the end of your Fulbright grant. You're eligible to reapply. So circumstances now are such that if your grant was cut short due to the pandemic, you are eligible to apply for the current academic year. But in a normal situation, there is a two-year waiting period from receiving your grant and applying for the next one. But I hope that answered your question. But yes, obviously we want to make sure that people are as safe as possible and returning home if necessary. We have a question is about Hong Kong. Yes, China and Hong Kong, the program is suspended to those countries, so we are not having any grantees going there. Well, no one is traveling this fall on the program. The program has been suspended for the spring, and the application is closed for the 21-22 academic year. Can you have multiple hosts? Yes, you can. I would definitely... oh, sorry, it's been answered already, but in the chat box. But yes, read the descriptions of the awards, but if the project you'd like to do requires you to visit more than one institution, or you'd like to partner with more than one, you're usually able to do that. Just make sure that both of the hosts are on board with the project and that collaboration is seamless and that it's articulated clearly to the reviewers when you put together your application. So, yes, that's in terms of reviewing particular of having more than one host within a country. If you'd like to visit more than one country, then we would encourage you to look at the regional research opportunities. I have something here saying that they didn't hear sound. Hopefully that has been corrected and that you can hear us now. I have an inquiry here. What type of special arrangements are made? I'm going to make this a little bit larger. Due to the pandemic. In other words, if somebody receives a Fulbright, but the time comes, she does not feel the health conditions are safe enough to go, what happens? Can it be deferred to the next year? If not, it declines. Does this hurt their chances of the following year? And helpful for planning? Okay, got it. So, yes, the situation at hand is as of March, the Fulbright program has been suspended worldwide. So the grantees who were on the ground in March have returned. As much as possible, we're given the choice and funding to return home. The policies of the program are being revisited every 30 days. So for those and in March, they also made the decision that the people who are scheduled to leave for the 2020-21 academic year, which is the one coming up this fall, all of those fall grants have been delayed start date no sooner than January of 2021. Now, should things continue to change, and they're not able to take the grants in the spring. So obviously, if you were, for example, your sabbatical was for the fall and you can't take the spring, then if you did not accept the Fulbright grant, then you're definitely eligible to reapply for the following year. And if, for example, you're planning to leave in the spring, but there's problems happening and you're not comfortable going, the country's not, whatever it is, and you declined the grant in the spring, then you are declining your grant, which will still make you eligible to reapply for the fall. Which is the deadline, however, that decision will need to be made sooner rather than later because the deadline for next fall is this September 15th. So it's difficult when you're dealing with uncertainty and different levels of comfort in terms of ambiguity of what's coming up next. But if you have any questions, definitely reach out to our program staff and we can try to help you make as informed decision as possible. But generally speaking, if you are a grant, if you have received a grant for next spring and you're not comfortable, I would encourage those people to definitely apply for the September 15th deadline coming up for next fall. Now, if you are not currently current grant recipient of the Fulbright program for this fall or next spring, and you're applying for the next fall, if next fall the world is still not open, or if next fall doesn't work out for you or anything like that, will you be able to defer or anything? No. You would just be, again, eligible to reapply for that following September deadline for the following fall. And we are waiving those eligibility the restrictions of not applying, that wait period of applying 2 years in between grants, because if you decline, then you're not officially a grantee, and then that should allow you to reapply for the program. As you develop your project idea, do you need to specify any particular people at the target institution who will be working with you outside of the person who provides their letter of invitation? I think, yes, if you think identifying those people would better help the reviewers get a sense of the work that you're doing. The people who will be reviewing applications are in your field, so if you think that would be helpful for them to get a better sense of who exactly you're collaborating with, yes, I would definitely specify people if you can, but I wouldn't necessarily say it's a requirement. It would really just depend on the nature of the work that you're doing. If it's integral for you to be able to accomplish what you're doing by collaborating with that person, then yes, I would definitely mention it. Can we give advice about how to find a collaborating institute in the country if you don't have that? Yes, so there was a slide I briefly discussed that earlier. The first place I would look would be on that catalog of awards. They might have a specific list of institutions that they're open to partnering with. In the case of Indonesia, they just gave a list of the whole higher ed community in that country. But some countries will be specific, like the Algiers example that I provided earlier. So I would look and see if there are names and contacts provided for that particular country. If not, definitely look at that scholar directory on our website to see what U.S. scholars have gone abroad, and if they want to, somebody is in your field as a colleague, reach out to them and say, you know, are they familiar with anybody who's doing this work that you're doing, if they could put you in touch with them. Or definitely reach out to those visiting scholars who are in the United States from those countries, just as you would likely, you know, be open to, receptive to somebody reaching out to you saying, can you put me in touch with a particular department, or do you know somebody working in this field? If you're able to provide that sort of professional courtesy of getting them in touch with the right people, I think our Fulbrighters are definitely happy to assist others in this work of finding that. Another place is to that's to work for finding a particular institute. Another thing to do is find people that are publishing in your field. I think you all, as you are in journals or publishing books or chapters or anything like that, reach out to people who are working in that to see and address, like, we're working in the same field. Would you be interested in collaborating with me on this particular topic, or is your institution working on this? Is this something we can work together on? Those would all be great places to start. Is it possible to get guidance during these office hours on a specific proposal? I'm sorry, we do not do specific proposal review, just because of, one, it is a competition, and we want to make sure that the people who are competing are not getting any sort of preferential treatment or anything like that. Earlier on in the process, like possibly as we start to open the competition, if you want to share your CV or an abstract with us, I think like we're able to comment and guide, but in terms of reviewing your 3 to 5 page project statement, I'm sorry, we can't really sit down with your proposal. But if you have an idea you'd like to pitch, the larger group in that office hour might be able to share. But we also have some considerations in terms of intellectual property that we need to be sensitive on. But definitely reach out if you think we can be of any assistance without being too involved in that. So we have another question about the pandemic. If Americans cannot travel to the host country at the time of fellowship, yes. So right now, the 2020-2021 academic year is delayed to start in January of 2021. Those decisions are reviewed every 30 days by the U.S. State Department, obviously depending on, depending on the state of affairs in that particular country and entry and all of that, that will be reviewed on a case-by-case basis, country-by-country basis almost even. And if the country is not, if you're not allowed to travel or open to travel to the country at the time of the fellowship, it'll be addressed on a case-by-case basis then. I'm sorry, I'm still getting a couple more people that don't have sound, but this is earlier on in the discussion, so hopefully it's been resolved. Do awards fund any equipment that might be required to conduct research? So yes, there was some countries will have supplemental research allowances that will help you fund books, equipment, fees, permits, etc. That will depend and vary from country to country, but some awards will definitely have funds for those types of equipment. It would be assumption and expectation that that equipment stays in country upon your departure. So keep that in mind too. Should the research project in the country be comparative in nature? So it can be. I think oftentimes that tends to be a good idea because we are, again, trying to promote understanding between the cultures and countries, but it doesn't necessarily have to be. In the case of the example that I did pull up, it did say, you know, the projects that explore the comparative studies or comparative nature of things, that was highlighted in that last award, but it doesn't need to be. I would read the award description carefully, and if there's any indication that that's something that they value, then yes, I would definitely encourage it. It should be, if not comparative, at the very least, it should be collaborative, and it would be good to have different perspectives in terms of the approach that you're taking to answer whatever question you're trying to answer. Academic guidelines listed in the description does not coincide with what I've been told by the hosting institution. Is that a problem? I'd need a little bit more information about that. I would go by the catalog of award, what's in the award description, just because the hosting institution, I don't want to call them secondary, because depending on the country, they might literally be the primary partner in that, but the catalog of awards is written in conjunction with either the Fulbright Office or the U.S. Embassy in that country, and therefore the ultimate decision makers in terms of which projects are going to receive funding and all of that. So what I would do is make sure that the hosting institution is in touch with either the office in that country just to make sure that they're on the same page. But if I were you, I would make sure that you're following the description of the catalog of awards to ensure that because that is what you're being judged against in terms of the reviewers. I had a research fellowship to Japan 9 years ago. Can I apply for research teaching? Yes, absolutely. Yes. 9 years ago is plenty of time. There's a 2-year waiting period between Fulbright grants now, and you didn't even discuss if that was necessarily a Fulbright, so you're absolutely in the clear. If you don't have experience in a given country but have a strong invitation letter, will your project read as competitive? Yes, I absolutely think so. So definitely, some countries even prefer those who don't have a lot of experience in that country. So definitely look at the country overview where they'll spell that out. I have a question about Korea. Korean adoptee required to show proof of relinquished citizenship and still have that visa card. Is it sufficient evidence to relinquish citizenship, or do you need to fill? It looks like this person has left, but if you've relinquished citizenship and you are a U.S. citizen, then that should be more than adequate. I would definitely read the country description for Korea, because I think they have some language in there regarding wanting people who are not that familiar with Korea, but if you're an adoptee and you've been in the United States at a very young age, I'm making some assumptions here, but then you should be fine. But I would definitely look closely at that. But if that citizenship was relinquished, you and are an American citizen, that will make you eligible. Are professional projects intended for non-academics? Yes, they are. That's an opportunity for people who might not necessarily want to go to a country to teach 3 classes of Mark Twain or whatever their subject might be. It's for professionals who either want to do research, or let's say you are a professional who is in the field of business or in a field of law or an artist who can public speaking and presentations and workshops and trainings are a regular part of your work. Demonstrate that while you might not necessarily be an academic, you can still go to that country and contribute and have some really meaningful exchanges and work there. So yes, professional projects are are generally a way for that country to express that they are interested to those outside of academia. You're interested in being in Taiwan but haven't identified an institution there, then I would definitely take a look at the scholar directory to see who, what institutions in Taiwan have affiliated already and hosted Americans. I would check to see what Taiwan nationals are in the United States and what institutions they're from to see if any of them would be interested in collaborating with you on your project, or if they know somebody out there, institution, who does similar work as you, and to get you in touch with them. If we have funding that we can use to support some preliminary research and preparation, should you mention that? Yes, I think it would be an advantage to share. Fulbright has no problems. In fact, we encourage dovetailing of things. We don't have a problem with that. Your other funding source may have concerns about that, but Fulbright does not. The more you can demonstrate that Fulbright is going to be collaborative and in partnership, or that you've already, that Fulbright would be able to get you to that next stage of whatever a particular project is, that is definitely an advantage to demonstrate that you're already doing work and preparing for this work. Fulbright will just sort of be a way to get you to that next level, next stage of the project, so to speak, or the next milestone in whatever you're trying to work on. Family friendliness of the Fulbright program is a major appeal to you, great, but it's something I should include, or is it seen as less serious? Family friendliness, so the project statement should really be about your project, right? So anything outside of that, if you can definitely include maybe several lines or two about the impact that you anticipate this having on your family, if this is important to you, and you see that it's important to the country that you're applying to as well. But I wouldn't, again, you have 3 to 5 pages, so I would make sure that that's as concise as possible and as robust of a presentation of the day-to-day activities of what you're doing in-country. So, yes, I would include it, but I would not include it at the cost of real estate in your project statement. When I was filling out the application, I just want to be sensitive of time here. We're about 1 minute away, and we have quite a few questions. Happy to keep answering them as we are able, but I know some folks are probably going to have to move on, and I know I am restricted as well on my own schedule, but I'll try to continue to get through as many of these as I can. When I was filling out the application, it asks about an employer. If you don't want to disclose that. If you don't have an employer, you don't want to disclose that. If you don't want to disclose it, then you don't have to disclose it. I'm sorry, I'm trying to understand. Or you don't want to represent that institution, that's understandable, then I would just be clear about that and consistent about it. If that's on your resume or your CV, I would just address it then. If it's on your CV that's your particular appointment, but you don't really want to list them, then I would just somehow address that so that the reviewers won't have a particular question on that end. Who should we be targeting when seeking someone to provide our letter of invitation? It should be the person you're collaborating with on that campus or that facility. So if you're going to a research center or you're collaborating with whoever you're working with should be able to demonstrate that yes, they know who you are, and yes, should you receive the funding, they'd be interested in hosting you and working with you on that project. Yes, there'll be a recording of this. Does the teaching component in a combined teaching award have to be an entire term long course, or is it invited to talk a class a semester? That is spelled out in the catalog of awards. Some countries will specifically say teaching research should be 60-40, or teaching research should be 50-50, or teaching research is up to the discretion of the grantee to figure out with their host. So all of that will depend on your institution, so the institution you're collaborating with, and the award that you're applying to. So read that award description carefully. Reach out to us if you need any help with that interpretation of that. But yeah, you should. It can be invited to talk to a class if they're not clear or specific. That should be adequate. Again, but only if that host institution is on board with it. That is correct. There's an intent to end Fulbright exchange with China and Hong Kong. That is correct. The program to Hong Kong and China is suspended for the time being. Received a specialist grant. Are you eligible to apply for the award cycle in 2018? It depends on when your award to India was in 2018. There's a 2-year max, so depending on when that is, you should be fine. 2018 to September 2020. Ah, and I see my colleague has answered several of your questions already. I'm just going to go ahead and skip those. Thank you. Waiting period taken care of. Wonderful. Classes start in 10 days. Thank you for stopping by. Looks like, okay, we have a couple more that were not answered. What are typical approaches to the bibliography? Can it be written as a series of mini literature reviews, each describing research in a certain domain and providing relevant references? That's tough. I guess it's a matter of if you're using your bibliography to describe your research, then that should be fine. Literature review is fine, but usually it's the citations. So I don't know why, what added value it would be to have it in that format that you're discussing. So something to think about. The typical approach would be citation and a listing of the bibliography that has informed the research and that you'll be relying on to do the work that you're doing. How is COVID-19 expected to affect the scholarship assignment? It's not at this moment, because for September 15th, the awards we're talking about are going to be for fall 2021 and spring 2022. So the program is up and running as far as we are concerned for the September 15th deadline. Other questions were answered. Thanks. With COVID-19 again, budget allocation from Congress, pandemic ease up next year. We don't know how COVID-19 will affect the awards next year. So again, if you're talking about the spring of 2021, that is actually the 2021 academic year, 2020-2021 academic year, and that funding has been allocated and will be spent. Everything that we've been talking about in this discussion has been for September 15th deadline, which is for the 2021-2022 academic year, which is funded and is full steam ahead. How important is it to get letters of recommendation from outside your own institution? I would definitely encourage that to be the case, because you want to see the breadth and scope of your work and how it has, I guess it would depend on your research, your work, your project as well, your teaching or research, but I do encourage that at least one should be outside your, one of the two should at least be outside your institution, so that we can get us, the reviewers can get a sense of the scope of what you're trying to accomplish and the work that you're doing. Are course outlines or syllabi required if you're doing seminars or invited talks, not talking over a full course of a term? I would say course outline or syllabi are required if you are doing a seminar or a talk. I would just modify it. It might not necessarily have to be a formalized syllabi, but I would still demonstrate to them what your talking points might be, just so that they get a sense of what is going to be covered in those seminars. This might sound strange, but it's worth asking. I have a dog. Okay. The pets, depending on the country, pets are allowed to go with you. That'll really depend on the country. So let us know. Reach out to us, and we can provide you some insights in terms of what other Fulbrighters have brought their pets with them for more information. But that is something that has happened. Are China programs terminated? They are suspended for the time being. Page limits on the application files, 3 to 5 pages for your project statement. Yes. Is it okay for there to be an overlap in the form questions and the statement of grant purpose? Yes, overlap is fine. I would avoid it because, you know, you only have so much space and time. I would make sure that you're using the most as efficiently as possible. Again, project statement is going to be boots on the ground, grant activities once you arrive in country, the sort of questions that you are being asked in those different four statements, why Fulbright, et cetera, that's really your opportunity to speak about the value or importance of this grant outside of your project statement on a personal level. If I could get 3 letters of recommendation, should I? I would say no. There's no need for that. I'm confused. Okay, those have been answered. Sorry. Ooh, quite a few questions here. I'm going to give it about 10 more minutes of answering these, and then unfortunately, all of these are fantastic questions. Feel free to swing by our office hour tomorrow, and a few of us will try to plug in and answer more of these. What difference does the history of grants have? If a grant has had a scholar in a similar field, is it recommended to look for another host? It will depend on that country. So I would definitely check in that catalog of awards to see if that's something that the country values. If it says something along the lines of wanting to reach a wide audience in that country or diversify their level of institutions that are participating in the program, though that's the kind of language that I would watch out for, and then maybe, yeah, branch out to different regions or different institutions in the country. Okay. Candidate profile, currently an administrative adjunct faculty, PhD in 25 years academic. Are you an academic? Yes. You are definitely qualified. It sounds 25 years in the academy and a PhD. You are definitely, the profile and candidate qualifications sound like they would meet our opportunities, so definitely have a look. When is PhD required, does it mean artist and terminal degree? MFA is enough. MFA is a terminal degree. For dependents, does Fulbright help locate schools for awardees of children? In some countries they will, in some countries they will not. So that's definitely something to, that'd be a great question for our alumni, if you can reach out to alumni who have taken children with them. But some countries definitely will help you identify schools for them. Is it compelling to have a strong invitation letter? And I'm looking for a specific program that a host country uniquely has. Yes, that strong invitation letter is if it says it's preferred or required, that can make or break. That can really set you apart from other candidates, as long as knowing that there's somebody in that country who already knows you and willing to partner with you. Does one have to have a home institution? No, we have independent scholars going on grants regularly. If you are not affiliated with an institution, can you only apply for postdocs, or are you able to apply for early career awards? You are not required to have a home institution. We have independent scholars and professionals going on grants, so provided you meet the qualifications and requests of the award in terms of experience and level of work and teaching experience, then you are eligible to apply. Did the host institution get money from Fulbright? That will depend on the country. In often cases, those institutions are paying the Fulbright program, not the other way around. So the concept of free labor is not quite accurate. These institutions are usually contributing quite a lot to be able to participate in the program, if not the country. For dependents, does Fulbright help locate schools? Yep, I discussed that already. Thailand All Disciplines Award, told verbally that a representative, that they begin in June. Okay, I don't see a question here, but that's fantastic. Yeah, if you already have a country and a university and have that letter of invitation, definitely full speed ahead. Please apply. Best way to initiate contact with an institution, I discussed that one already. Struggling to get your letter of invitation, I know it seems a bit hopeless at the moment, but keep in mind, you have until October 15th to get that together, and hopefully your colleagues abroad will have a chance to respond to you. You got past the first round, but didn't get past the second round. Do I need new letters of recommendation? You don't need to, but I would encourage you to. I mean, yes, you should need to, I guess is what I'm saying. We won't be able to transfer anything over. Like, you would need to resend it to us either way. Would it be good to have a refreshed date on it? Yes. Are there opportunities sooner than the next academic year, perhaps with a specialist program? I would refer you to the World Learning Organization. They are the ones who administer that. But as I mentioned, the program is suspended at least until the spring of next year. More COVID questions, which I've already responded. If the pandemic doesn't ease, then the program will continue to be suspended. But there is no deferral. So if you are not anticipating going on your grant, I would encourage you to apply for that next round. We mentioned non-binding letter of invitation. Should this be explicitly stated? Yes. When you ask for the letter, just say that it is a non-binding letter of invitation, that, you know, should you receive the Fulbright grant, they would be happy to work with you and hosting you on campus. I mean, obviously, the stronger that language could be, that they would be most happy to collaborate with you on that would be in your best interest. So the points of contact beside the institution, the nation's Fulbright office, the consul and embassy, I would always encourage you to reach out to us first and foremost so that we can get you in touch with the right person. But if this is regarding the letter of invitation, then yes, reach out directly to those institutions. The Fulbright office in that country or the consulate or embassy may not be especially responsive depending on where you are in the process. So always start with us. Fulbright scholars are vetted and chosen by panels in that host country. Is it then moved to a round where the host country would have the opportunity to the schoolers? Yes. So Fulbright, the first round is here in the United States by a panel of your peers, and then if it's recommended for further consideration, it goes to the host country for final selection. So yes, but it's not seen in that country unless it passes review first in the U.S. Could Fulbright grant also go to writing a book? Yes, regarding that research, Fulbright, many people publish on their grants. You cannot apply to more than one location at a time. You want to collaborate at two different institutions? Yes, you will be required to get two letters of invitation. That would be ideal. Process of applying for a global scholarship is one more competitive, or the regular U.S. scholar program. Yes, the global scholar program is absolutely the most competitive of all of our processes because the review criteria for that is especially difficult in that several countries are going to need to review your application. So I would definitely, if you have, and usually when you get those letters of invitation, you'll have one country or one institution that sort of rises to the top as the strongest. So I would almost always recommend that you apply for the U.S. Scholar Award over the Global Scholar Award. Can I repeat what I said about China? The program to China and Hong Kong are suspended for the current year as well as for the 21-22 academic year. We're almost at the end, I think. Preferred disciplines for Japan are broad. What should we keep in mind when applying? So when they say something like contemporary society, that says to me that Japan is tired of people researching Japanese history, so keep it into the modern era, whatever work that you're doing. If you have an existing connection, a faculty member that has worked in that country, you would like to work again, will this hurt or help the application review? It will depend. If that host can illustrate how what you're going to be doing is building upon that or separate from that, or in some way what you're doing is going to be a completion of that work, I can see that being really strong for you. But if it's basically going there to do the exact same thing someone already did, then that would be detrimental for you. So it's all about framing. I've been in contact with the university. They'll be writing a letter of support. This will be your first application. University is not listed when you search by that country. Is that okay? A country needs to say that it's open to all institutions. And as long as that's there, then any institution in country is fair game. What does the history of grants have? If they've had it in a similar field, it again, it's one of those things that'll depend. If you're adding something to the conversation, fantastic. But if you're basically replacing somebody doing the exact same work, I would see that country looking not so great on that. Having been in the country previously is a disadvantage. Is that true? In some countries it is, in some countries it isn't. They'll be explicit in that in the country overview. Applying for a research grant, a letter of invitation from a foundation, that is fine as long as you're doing that work with them. Requirements for domestic partners who are accompanying you, there are none. Domestic partners are spouses and dependents. Well, are they? I guess I should ask if they're spouses. If they're spouses, they are considered dependents and are eligible for funding as well in some countries. Previous Fulbright, is it a good idea to get one from the letters of a Fulbright colleague? Again, hey Liz, it will depend. If they have something to add and can strengthen and can articulate why you need a second Fulbright or a third, depending on where you are, then yes, I would get that letter from a colleague who is a Fulbrighter as well. All disciplines in Australia, something that really confuses you. That's pretty specific, so hopefully you can just reach out to us for more details on that. Okay, we are at 3:16. I'm afraid I'm going to have to cut this conversation short, but all of you, please for sure reach out to us in the chat box for the office hour tomorrow, because another colleague of mine will be joining in that discussion, Michelle Borucci, and we'll be able to answer some of those questions as well within the chat box if the conversation doesn't lead us this way. But thank you all very much. Sorry to not get to all of your questions, but we have these office hours pretty regularly. And thank you for your attention. Oh, I do have a couple more slides, just additional Fulbright opportunities and contact information for some non-scholar grants. And last, I'll end on this slide, which is just opportunities and your homework. Refer your colleagues, visit cis2.org to sign up for more updates and follow us on all of our social media profiles. So thank you all very much. I'd like to thank Chanel as well for helping with the chat box. Reach out again with any questions, but please stop by our office hours tomorrow. A few of us will be in the chat box as well, answering questions there in more detail. We look forward to receiving your application, and best of luck to you all in your application. Have a great day, everybody. Thank you.